The Late Lunch with Miranda Tetlow.
In hindsight, this is the moment that saved my life.
On ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
And you don't meet many people who've devoted their lives to the pursuit of justice, but that's the best way to describe Lima Nguyen. Lima's a barrister in the Northern Territory specialising in human rights and criminal law. She was born in a refugee camp in Indonesia before coming to Australia. And over the years, her work has taken her from Timor and Nigeria to Cambodia, representing victims of genocide. As you're going to hear, Lima's passion for justice is rooted deeply and perhaps starts with her family story, an incredible tale of escape from Vietnam. Lima, it's so lovely to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here, Miranda.
Lima, you were born on Kuku Island in Indonesia, a refugee camp there. Can you tell me a bit about your parents and how they came to be seeking asylum?
Yes, so my parents were both born in the south of Vietnam, and during their youth and their early adulthood, there was a real absence of freedom, but also violence in the community because of the communist regime and the way that they ran the country. For example, my father would talk to me about the bombing of cinemas and restaurants so that people didn't feel that they were safe to, you know, go out and hang out. He couldn't finish his law degree because his university was burnt down and they burnt all the books. And my mother has her own story. She wasn't someone who was very politically active, but because of a raid that took place on her house by the communist regime, where they found a photo of her with some American troops, she was then suspected of being a spy and a government dissident. And so she was actually interned at a camp for with two other dissidents who were actively involved in speaking out against the government and handing out flyers and things like that. But for my mother, it was really just an innocent photo. The guys down the road just wanted to take a photo with a pretty lady before they were going to be deployed back to the United States. So my parents both had their own stories of being interned in these camps, and they went through an initial escape attempt which was unsuccessful, where they were actually hauled back to the mainland of Vietnam by the Vietnamese Navy and subsequently sent to what's known as re-education camps, where there were quite appalling conditions, including torture, that was what they tried to flee from again. So
certainly an amount of gumption needed to flee, not once but twice. How did that second escape attempt run out for them?
So my father, both of my parents were interned at this re-education camp, and my father had made his way up the ranks to become a kitchen hand. So he was able to have a little bit of freedom in terms of going outside of the camp to buy foods and groceries. And that kind of gave him some ideas as to how it was that he could plan an escape from the camp. At the time, my mother had my sister, who was in her toddler years, and so she was given special consideration and allowed to return back to her hometown, which was near Saigon. So she left first, but my father had carefully planned out his escape attempt together with another prisoner at the camp. And they left in the dark of the night to a river area where they stole someone's paddle boat and were able to paddle down the river, make their way to a train station and catch a train back to where they were reunited with my mother.
And then the boat trip to Indonesia. What did your parents tell you about that crossing?
Well, because the first escape attempt was unsuccessful, and it was really because it was not properly planned out. So in the first escape attempt, my father was the captain of a fishing boat. There were a number of asylum seekers on board. He left when he thought it was safe to leave, but he hadn't carefully measured out the wind state and the currents and, you know, the landscape underneath the sea before escaping. So even though they were on the high seas or what they thought was the high seas for 3 days and three nights, they actually weren't making very much leeway. And when they saw an island in the distance, they headed towards the island thinking that that was Indonesia or, you know, Malaysia or one of the further islands. But in fact, it was the south of Vietnam. They only realized that when they approached the island and saw the Vietnamese slogans, which were depicted on signs around the area. So they were pretty desperate by that stage because they actually had run out of water and food supplies and things like that. And my father, upon realizing that they were actually at the bottom of Vietnam, took the engine towards the sea again. But someone, one of the asylum seekers, was getting quite desperate. And I think he was thinking, you know, if they go out to sea, there is no way they're going to survive. So he stopped the boat, and the Navy boat was able to catch up with them and tug them back to land. And that must have been a terrifying experience for them, because, you know, one could only imagine at that time what their fate would be, having unsuccessfully escaped.
So second time around, they had a bit more insight about what they needed to do to, yeah, to get the whole distance.
Yes.
So what did they say about that journey?
Yeah, so it's my father who told me this story. In order to justify having a fishing boat, he had to enter into a partnership with someone else and buy a whole lot of timber so that they could justify that they were in the business of buying and selling timber. But my father tells me that the other man ended up selling the timber and running away with the money. So there were a couple of hurdles along the way, but my father ended up with the fishing boat. This time he was a lot more careful about, you know, looking at the weather, looking at the sand dunes and the geography of the land underneath the waters, because if you didn't travel in a certain direction, you could bump into the sand dunes and essentially not be able to progress any further. So he carefully studied all of those things and chose a night when he considered that they were under cloak of darkness and wouldn't be discovered, and that the wind and the current conditions were right. So this time they were again on the seas for 3 days, three nights, and were able to reach Indonesia.
And the other thing for your mother through all this, you know, despite everything else that's scary, she's also heavily pregnant, isn't she?
Yes. And this is the thing about my mother. Every time, you know, I get into trouble, she always reminds me of this story, you know. So, yes, she was pretty much 9 months pregnant or very close to, and it was one of the most horrific experiences of her life that she's told me, to be out on the seas, you know, during storms and fear that there might be pirates around, which there were many in those days, and having to go through like seasickness as well. But she managed to give birth to me almost on arrival. It was not so much on arrival on the mainland, because they initially encountered a US oil rig in the middle of the seas, and the crew of the US ship saved the asylum seekers, who by now probably they were assessing that the boat wasn't too seaworthy. So the US crew transferred the asylum seekers onto their larger boat and accommodated them on board for 2 weeks. And during that time, they heliported my mother to the mainland with my father to give birth to me on the island.
Just an extraordinary story. So you were born into that refugee camp, and your family ended up making their way to Australia on a humanitarian visa. You arrived in Brisbane. What was this new life like for your family?
Well, I was quite young at the time, so, you know, I'm probably living vicariously through the memories of my parents as they've conveyed to me. But when we arrived in Australia, we literally had nothing on our backs. My father worked odd jobs when they first settled in Australia. So he worked initially as a cleaner, and my mother and father then worked all these factory jobs through my childhood. So they basically had to rebuild an entire life from scratch. And I think that's made our family and myself, you know, the way that I grew up and the way that I was raised, to become very resourceful. Yeah. So, you know, I remember when we were kids, we didn't have that many toys. So I remember doing things like making trucks and cars and dolls out of toilet paper and tissue box containers and, you know, or anything that we could gather together. And I don't know how many kids do that these days, but it sort of enables a creative flow from a very young age as well.
Even the story of your first guitar is an example of resourcefulness, I think, too. Tell me about that.
Yes. So when I was little, our family trips to the dump was always a bit of a treasure hunt. It wasn't just, you know, to get rid of our garbage. We actually used the opportunity to find toys, and I got my first guitar from the dump. It was like a 3/4 sized sunburst colour guitar, so it was just the right size for a child. I think I was 9 at the time, and that's when I first started to learn the guitar from my father.
You're listening to Late Lunch. Miranda Tetlow is my name. My guest today is Territory Barrister Lee Man Nguyen, sharing some of her family story from Vietnam to Indonesia and then to Australia. Lima, was being a lawyer something that you always wanted to do?
I think I always had a very strong sense of, you know, justice and human rights concepts like freedom and liberty. And that stemmed from way back in my childhood, in terms of the way that I was raised in an Asian household. But I was also quite heavily involved with clubs and societies like Amnesty International, and Red Cross, Oxfam Community Aid Abroad, things like that, during my high school and university years. I was president of Amnesty International in high school and at uni. And I think that my involvement with that organisation really had a lasting impression upon me as to the importance of giving voice to those who do not have a voice, and particularly those who find themselves in situations such as being a prisoner of conscience because they simply believe in a certain ideology or religion or a way of being. I've never really looked at it in this manner, but my mother was actually a prisoner of conscience in her own way. The Vietnamese state had suspected her of dissidents because of the photo that they found at her house. And for that reason, she was imprisoned. So, in fact, she was imprisoned with the other two ladies who were prisoners of conscience. And she was suspected of being such a prisoner. So I've never really actually looked at it in that full circle kind of way. But certainly when I was president of Amnesty and doing these letter writing campaigns and awareness raising campaigns, the stories of those who were in appalling conditions in other countries on account of their conscience, their beliefs, to me, you know, it raised some real questions about what it means to be a fellow human being and to have the freedoms that we have, which these people are denied.
And this has been the basis of the work that you've taken on and that you've pursued over your career, and you did some volunteer stints in Timor and Nigeria. I think there's so many different cases and experiences we could talk about, but perhaps one that stands out is, I think, the work that you did with people who'd survived the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia is really striking. Can you tell me a little bit about how you came to work with those survivors?
Yes. So I was involved with a group of lawyers which had started the organisation called Access to Justice Asia, based in Singapore. And in 2008, they wanted to do some pro bono work in Cambodia. We didn't initially foresee that the type of pro bono work that we were going to do was going to move into the area of victims' rights and victims' representation. And that was because in 2007, when the tribunal started to become operational, there was still a lot of gaps in the processes. Now, in that jurisdiction, victims of crime could apply to become what's known as civil parties, where they have procedural rights in the genocide trials to participate in the criminal procedure alongside the defence and the prosecution. And what was sort of the elephant in the room was that there were so many victims in that mass historical serious crime setting. So pretty much everyone who was over the age of 30 was a victim of crime, because the criminal acts sort of pervaded the whole of Cambodia. The charges that the senior leaders of the Democratic Kampuchea, also known as the Khmer Rouge regime, faced were charges against not only various minority groups, but the general population in terms of the starvation, forced labour camps, and executions that some of those groups had come through. The main group, though, that I represented within Cambodia was the ethnic Vietnamese minority group who resided on the Tonle Sap River. They were a group who had lived in Cambodia for generations, so their parents, grandparents were born there, and they were also born there. And I came across this group in my work with the various NGOs that did the human rights outreach work. It sort of just made sense for me to represent them because I speak the Vietnamese language, and that was a critical aspect of building the trust and the confidence with this group that was needed to, you know, collate their stories, to enable them to speak of some of the horrific crimes that they had endured, and to give them the trust that they needed to be able to speak about that.
So what sort of experiences were people telling you about that they'd been through?
A lot of families had gone through mass executions. A lot of people had, that there were some stories of rape as well. Unfortunately, the people who could speak about the rape of young girls in that area eventually passed away, and with their passing was also the inability to really have them give evidence about those things at the tribunal. But, you know, their stories were still collected in the form of statements. But that's also one of the consequences of having a proceeding that's a historical proceeding dealing with crimes, you know, that took place over 30 years ago, 40 years ago, is that a lot of it is to do with survivor testimonies. And those who don't survive aren't able to give that testimony. So one of the most important things about my ethnic Vietnamese minority group that I found was that during the genocide of that group, the demographic experts who also were able to give evidence in that proceeding, you know, gave evidence that when the genocide acts had escalated and crystallised, this was in about 1978 to 1979, there was a pretty much a 100% elimination of any ethnic Vietnamese people who remained in Cambodia. And the reason that my clients were able to survive the regime was because they had been transferred forcibly, deported out of Cambodia to Vietnam. And during the time in Vietnam, they lived in refugee-like conditions there. But when they felt safe enough to come back to Cambodia, because they did consider Cambodia to be their homeland, in the 1980s, they did make the return. The difficulty for them was that when they returned to Cambodia, they were not able to prove who they were. They weren't able to prove their long-term residence in Cambodia and any identification or legal or civic status that they had in Cambodia in the past. So all of that had to be explored, because what I found was that the victims in this group were all asking for Cambodian nationality by way of the moral and collective reparations that they were entitled to under the rules. When they came back from Vietnam to Cambodia, any status that they previously had just wasn't recognised.
The group thanked you in a way that was really moving. What did they do?
So this is a story that I will probably always come back to. When I represented the groups, I liaised a lot with the village chief, and the village chief of one of the villages that I represented was an elderly lady. She would bring me fish from the Tonle Sap River, and on this occasion she had travelled all the way from Kampong Shnung to Phnom Penh to meet with me. We were supposed to be taking statements from her, and that was my purpose that I had, my mission that I had to do on that occasion. But when I saw her, she had these two big fish that she said was the biggest and the best from the Tonle Sap River. She had carefully prepared the fish, dried them, salted them, wrapped them up in the Phnom Penh Post newspaper, and she instructed me to bring them back to Australia for my parents, which is a very Asian thing. You know, that when you give thanks to somebody, it's kind of like you give thanks to their whole family. I was very heartened, but at the same time, I couldn't think of anything other than the treatment that I was going to get at the airport from bringing in these two big fish to the international ports. And, you know, I was thinking about the quarantine and customs regulations and what I would be doing in breach of those. I sort of nodded and said thank you, but she was very serious, and she started to give me instructions on how to cook the fish and all of that. And I had to say to her, Auntie, I'm not going to be able to bring this back. And I ate it in Cambodia and gave some away because they were very big fish.
The gesture was there, though.
It was, yeah.
You're listening to Late Lunch. My name's Miranda Tetlow. I'm speaking with Territory Barrister Lima Nguyen today. And you've been based in the Territory for the past decade, Lima. I wanted to finish on one of the cases, which is, I suppose, you know, indicative and representative of a lot of the people that you represent, which is that of an elderly Indonesian fisherman. Can you tell me some of his story?
Yes. So this was an ongoing kind of case. It went through three different trial listings. The offence that he was charged with, and he was charged together with another crew member, was the offence of fishing illegally in Australian waters, or commercial fishing illegally in the Australian fishing zone. He was an elderly gentleman from Indonesia, and he was a very noble kind of man. He was the master of his ship. That wasn't contested. Where they were fishing was an issue that was disputed in the trial. It was a matter that should have been dealt with in the summary jurisdiction, so the local court, and had it been dealt with there, it would have been a lot quicker. But the Commonwealth DPP saw fit to commit the matter to the Supreme Court. And this gentleman suffered from diabetes. The impact of the criminal offence also rendered him homeless. He was destitute by the time it got round to trial the second or third time, because he was suspended from his job as a fisherman pending the finalisation of the charges. His wife had left him. He was suffering from major depression at this time. So it was a very sad story. You know, it was a case where even the judge noticed that he wasn't quite all right, and we had to stand down the proceedings many times. He had to go to hospital many times, and I found myself, you know, running back and forth between court and hospital, and eventually the matter was discontinued, which meant that the charges were dropped against him, and he is now able to fish again back in Indonesia. But I guess one of the things that strikes me when I represent these Indonesian fishermen is the situation that they find themselves in and the situation that my family were in their country back, you know, in the 1980s. When I was born in Indonesia, you know, my parents just arrived and they were given some assistance. We didn't ask for anyone's permission to be there. And there I was, born on Indonesian soil. Then I represent these guys who are alleged to have crossed over into the Australian fishing zone in the middle of the seas where there are no, you know, perceivable boundaries. They're brought into the Australian criminal justice system. They're prosecuted here and, you know, I defend them. I must also add, in the past, when I was working with the Office of the Commonwealth DPP, I was tasked with prosecuting them as well. So, you know, but I always felt sorry for them, whatever the case. And when I defend them now, I just think, you know, you've come to Australia. This is what you're facing, the criminal justice system here. My family came to your country and we got asylum. So I never forget that, you know, life is just not black and white, that there are some real nuances in the way that life pans out. And I try never to take for granted my beginnings. And when I look at other people and the things that they've been through, to think that any one of us could have, you know, endured what anyone else endures.
What do your parents think when they talk to you about the work that you do or they think about the cases that you take on?
My parents convey their pride very stoically. I remember when I was starting to do some of this pro bono work in Cambodia, my parents would actually ask me, why are you spending your time on this? You know, you should be out there engaging in work that actually makes some money. And I think that that just reflects, you know, the mentality that when they came to Australia, they had nothing. They worked their butts off and, you know, got our family through to a place where we were able to study and reap the benefits of a good education. But I think throughout time, my parents have appreciated a great deal more the impact that that work has had on some of the client populations that I've represented. I've certainly come home with stories about the village chief and some of my ethnic Vietnamese clients who always are asking about my parents. And so that sort of ties them together as well and has helped them to understand the work that I've done and how it benefits those people who are far away from them.
And there must be a level where they can reflect on the sacrifices that they made to get you where you are and that you are then giving back in the same way.
Yes, I think so. And for my parents, it's more at the level of, oh, wow, Lima's getting interviewed by ABC Radio. Or, oh, wow, there's a photo of Lima in the Phnom Penh News on her feet in court at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal. She must be famous. So that's sort of the level, because I guess they see things a little bit simplistically. One of my greatest achievements in my career was in 2018 when I became accredited as counsel to represent victims of crime or accused persons charged with those crimes at the International Criminal Court. And to this day, sometimes I wonder if my parents really, you know, know what's going on. But when I speak to them, they certainly do express pride in their own way.
I'm sure they're very proud. Lima, it's been so great to speak with you today. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Miranda.
You've been listening to the chat I had with Lima Nguyen. Lima's a barrister based here in the Territory. She specialises in international law, human rights and criminal law, among other things, and it's work that has taken her overseas to Cambodia, representing survivors of the Khmer Rouge, but also inside prisons and detention centres right here in the Northern Territory as well. Last year, Lima was declared the 2020 overall winner of the 40 Under 40 Most Influential Asian Australian Leadership Awards, a real testament to her work, talent and tenacity. Miranda Tetlow is my name. I'll catch you next time.
ABC Radio Darwin.